Hi, friends. Welcome to the Reside Podcast. Here, we celebrate stories of individuals creating community in their own unique spaces. I'm Brooke, your host. Cultivating community is something I am so passionate about, which is why I created this podcast. Life isn't meant to be lived alone, and I hope you leave each episode feeling encouraged to make your own space a little better for everyone, and ultimately, know you aren't alone in your journey. On today's episode, I'm talking to my good friend, Blake Ball. Blake is a teacher at Yes Prep in Houston. He has an honest conversation with me about his journey to becoming a catalyst for race equity in the classroom and how, as an educator, it's more important than ever to open your ears and seek to understand where students are coming from, especially as a white teacher to Black and Brown students. I want to pause and say that Blake and I acknowledge that this is far from a perfect conversation about race. As two white people, we realize there are parts of this topic that we maybe got really wrong or spoke about imperfectly. We approach this conversation with open hands and welcome any correction or thoughts on how to have this conversation better. With that being said, let's jump into my conversation with Blake. Blake, welcome to the Reside Podcast.
Yes, excited to be here.
So we're recording during your spring break. Thanks for taking your free time to jump on the show. Speaking of spring break and Yes Prep and all of that, that is what we're talking about today. Just your background and experience and specifically your space of influence as being a teacher. But before we dive into that, can you just tell everyone a little bit about yourself? You know, you're in Houston, obviously, but how you ended up here and ended up at Yes Prep and all of those good things.
Yeah, for sure. So I was born and raised in Hawaii in a town called Lahaina on the island of Maui. So very, very proud of my roots there. And then after high school, I moved to Austin to go to the University of Texas. My mom grew up in Houston. And so I knew I kind of wanted to go to a larger university, expand my worldview a little bit. And when I got accepted, I was like, let's do it. They were really good at football at the time. And so I was like seeing them on TV. I was like, this is a cool school.
Who was the quarterback when they were good?
Vince Young.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. You're a Sooner.
They haven't really been good that's since. That's right. Sooner.
Oh, well, yeah. As soon as I got to the school, we did not do great in football. Nope. So you have that on me. But. No. Yeah. So I went to, college at UT, did 5 years, was a pre-med student. I got a degree in biology, but like my junior year, I was like, I don't really feel like I want to pursue this medical school route. I kind of lost passion for it. It just wasn't something that I was thinking about heavily. And I was like, if I don't want it that much, then maybe this isn't for me, you know? Mm. But I did get involved with Young Life, which is a Christian high school ministry. And I did volunteer with them and I really enjoyed that. So I knew I liked working with kids. And so, yeah, when I graduated, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. But, you know, one thing I do like, I do like being with the youths, you know? And so, I was like, oh, maybe give teaching a shot. You know, I was looking around, saw a flyer for Yes Prep. I had a friend that worked for Yes Prep at the time and she had nothing but good things to say about it. So I was like, let me interview. Let me just give it a shot. And then, yeah, I got a call back and I got an interview and I was super excited. First job out of college. And so I just jumped right in head first and that was really cool.
And is Yes Prep, I actually don't know if I know this, is Yes Prep a national organization or is it local?
We're local. We're only in Houston. I think we have about 20 schools across Houston. We have a few elementary schools that just opened. But yeah, so Yes Prep, for people who don't know, it's a public charter school system here in Houston. And so Yes actually is an acronym, stands for Youth Engagement Service, because service is one of our like big things where we do a bunch of service projects. And so it's really cool.
What was that like for you making the transition from, you know, you've spent your whole college career, like studying and with a goal, this one goal in mind, and then to just go down a completely different path. Was that hard at first?
Oh yeah, it was definitely hard. Definitely hard. Shout out to my dad who he kind of footed the bill with out of state tuition for 4 out of the 5 years. So it wasn't easy. And so, you know, having to have that conversation with him, be like, you know, I don't know if I want to pursue this anymore because like, I really, you know, I think I wanted to become a doctor because I just wanted to help people. Yeah. And I learned in college, there's a lot of different ways to help people besides medically. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, yeah, you know what? I don't know. It was just something that I thought about. I was like, okay, I got to go to medical school. It's going to be more time. It's going to be more money. And I kind of want to just get out and have a job and just make an impact right away. My mom was a teacher. She was a teacher.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. She was a teacher for a little bit. She was a biology teacher in San Marcos before she moved to Maui. So I guess the teaching gene was always kind of there.
There you go. Yeah. Well, and it was more than just a job right out of college for you, because you're still there. You're still at Yes Prep. Is it 5 years? How long have we been out of school for?
Six. This is my sixth year at Yes Prep.
That's crazy. So you made the transition, but then what made you like stay at Yes Prep?
So I got the job initially with a different Yes Prep school that I'm working at now. Well, I guess I didn't get the job. I got the interview with them. And so what you do for Yes, and probably for a lot of different schools as well, is you go in and you have to give a sample lesson. And so I went in and I gave my sample lesson. It was in geometry, but I did that. And then I was talking, then afterwards they interview me, like, and I was interviewing with the principal, and we were having a discussion about like my motivations and kind of like why I wanted it. She was like saying like, oh, you kind of seem like you have like this white savior mentality, and we want to make sure that like you don't kind of come in with that, because that's something that's like, you know, it's a racist narrative.
Yeah,
and at that point I was thinking like, I was like, you know what? I thought about it in that interview, and I'm like, I literally said, I'm like, what's wrong with a white savior mentality? You know, like, I want to help people. I want to save people. Isn't that something noble? Isn't that something that like, you know, I was kind of born, like I grew up with this mentality of like, you just got to help people. And if I'm a white savior, then so what? And that's like, that was my disposition. And I didn't get a call back. I did not get the job. And that kind of was like, oh, I really have to think about this now. And then I got this other interview with this other school, and I was able to get that job at Northside, where I'm at now. But even with those first few years into the teaching, I had this racist narrative, which I didn't really believe it was racist at the time. Because this white saviorism is basically like this racist narrative that Black and brown people inherently are lacking something, right? They're inherently they're in need of some sort of saving, which is not true, right? And so it's this like position that I had to put myself in. Wow, do you really think that your students need you? They actually need your help? And so what I had to do is like, I needed to do my job as a teacher, number one, right? I need to go in there and teach them, because that's what I got hired to do. And if anything, I was lacking in something, and that was being culturally competent.
Yeah.
You know, culturally aware of what's going on, of, you know, reading the room and figuring out where I'm at. You know, I didn't grow up with a lot of Black people. Like, there's not a lot of Black people in Maui and Hawaii in general. There's only a few at my school at that time when I was going. And so obviously culture shock, but also like, here's a group of people that have that, you know, for the most part, definitely way different upbringing than I ever had, right? Yeah. Not only in Houston, but because of, you know, I was in Hawaii, and so it's just this totally different area, but also like class wise. And here I was thinking that, you know, everyone's the same. We're all, you know, I was taught not to see color, not to see race. I was like, no, you know, he's like, you deny it. Just like, oh, we're all the same. You know, having that implicit bias in the very beginning challenged me for sure. I struggled hard as a teacher. I was, you know, in tears almost every day in the first one or two years, classes that I could just never control for classroom management purposes. But I was, because I was still teaching from this frame of like compliance, you know, I was like, you know, got to follow the rules. And it was very compliant based. And I struggled because I didn't focus on student relationships. Once I got into the groove of that, once I really kind of like understood that, my teaching got a lot better. But at the same time, that was like, you know, it was very challenging.
Yeah. You said a lot in that, and I want to unpack some of that. No, that was great. So really starting with what you were saying about having this white savior mentality and, you know, what's wrong with that, right? And I think what it boils down to is not seeing or like recognizing, and a lot of white people have that, like myself included, like not seeing those implicit biases or the prejudice or the racial things, like not seeing those things as being like racist or even a problem, really. What was that journey like for you? Because I know you have done a lot of like self-education on race equity, and you've obviously done a lot of work to try to make your classroom more like culturally competent and all of those things. Walk us through the journey of from that first interview to what you're doing now. And obviously it's still a learning journey.
Yeah, 100% still a journey Yeah, that's a good thing to put up front, because like I'm still learning a lot as I go through, and I've and being anti-racist, like, it's not something you arrive at. It's right. Basically like a lifestyle, right? So you constantly have to check that. You know, I guess looking back now, because I, like you said, I was doing a lot of reflection last year on everything going on. You know, when Ahmaud Arbery, when I saw the video of him getting shot and killed in the streets, right, murdered, and saw George Floyd get murdered. You know, I started to reflect a lot back, you know, when I was a first year, second year teacher, of how, you know, how I treated my Black students versus my Hispanic students. So our school is 90% Hispanic, about 10% Black. You know, there was a difference, right? I had this implicit bias going on in my head. And like, I was like, why are the, you know, Black students always getting in trouble, or I'm always yelling at them, or, you know, and they weren't the only ones. It wasn't just like a targeted thing, but they, you know, it's like, I look back and I'm like, wow, like I really had biases. Really, you know, like, and I messed up. And I think that's something that I was super hard to accept, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, I had some racist beliefs, or I had some, at least some biased beliefs for sure. Yeah. Microaggressions, all that stuff that I failed to see because I wasn't educated enough and I wasn't knowledgeable enough. And so one that broke my heart that I would do that, but I did. And that's something I had to face as I educated myself, as I learned to listen to Black people, learned to listen to their stories, listen to my Black students and what they're going through. Right. And so it was heartbreaking, but also like, okay, thank God I'm here now. Or like, thank God I'm like reflecting on this now than causing more harm and damage in the future. I had a student about that time, last year, about May, June, one of the students that I really struggled with in my first 2 years of teaching, he left the school in high school and went to a different school, but he was shot and killed in a robbery gone wrong in Houston. And that came up on the news around that same time. And so it was all these things that were happening in America, in my life. And I was just like, what is going on? Like, for me, I was like, I'm just waking up to this now. Like, why isn't everyone else waking up to this? Like, how many people? Because America doesn't, like, I was just so shocked that everyone's not on the same page about this, right? It's just like, it's political, it's debates, and it's just appalling to see. And from my view, from my perspective, I was like, man, I have to do better. I have to do better. I have to, you know, first step, educate myself. I have to read the books. I have to listen to the podcasts. I have to put myself in their shoes and have this empathy and just humble myself. And so I did that. So I was reading and through the summer, I just educated, bought a lot of books, was reading, and like, education is the very first step, right? And I think I would say that to anyone, that you gotta read, you gotta learn first, learn to listen, learn to humble yourself. Because if your first step is to like argue or, you know, kind of fight back on different things, and I mean, it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to like, but it's one thing to like automatically invalidate someone's story or experience just because you think you're more right than them, you know?
No, I think that you made a good point about seeking to understand, even. Like, at the root of it, that's what it is just we all have different experiences. And even as I have done some reflection on my learning journey, a lot of it is just making assumptions about other people's experiences or invalidating other people's experiences, but really coming from a place of like seeking just to understand their perspective and their walk of life, and that it is different. I think that what you said about reflecting on your experience and how you started and some of those like icky parts and maybe like, I don't know, for me, like shameful parts of, oh gosh, I can't believe I like acted that way or said those things. Or I think that a lot of people downplay the importance of that part of it. What do you think was the value for you in going back and like reflecting on some of those moments?
Yeah. So I look back at those moments and I always go back to this quote about like, you know, teachers, they don't, or people, isn't maybe, I don't want to butcher this quote, but it was like, people, maybe you can help me out. People, they don't remember what you've done, but they remember how you made them feel.
Oh, yeah.
Is that Maya Angelou?
I think you summarized it. Yep.
And so that quote really stuck with me because I'm like, how am I making my students feel, right? You know, when I yell at them for not behaving, how does that make them feel? If I send them out of the classroom because I can't deal with their behavior, what message is that sending to my students? You know, I think about like the school to prison pipeline, right? Of disproportionate, it happens at our school too, a disproportionate number of Black students get suspended. I don't know, it was a crazy number, but there's only 10% of Black students, but like the majority of them are getting suspended. And so I look at that and I'm looking like, wow, like this is a problem that we need to fix, right? This is something that I need to reflect on. And you think about the importance of reflecting on that, because our words have power, Brooke, like our words, they carry weight to them. And especially when you're middle school age, even high school age, those words can carry a lot of weight, and they can scar. They can really hurt someone at that age, especially if it's a teacher saying it to them, right? Especially if, you know, it's being said by someone in authority, who's supposed to protect you or supposed to, you know, guide you and teach you. And so to reflect upon that, it's like, I got to be so careful with what I say. And as teachers, we have to be so careful. I mean, be honest, be truthful, but know that your words carry weight. The last thing you want to do is do any sort of harm to these students. And the trouble is, you might do it without even thinking about it, right? This implicitness where you talked about implicit bias of like just ignoring the student, right? Or just kind of shutting them out, and these little things and big things really that are big things to them that they can carry with you. So reflecting upon that, I'm like, well, now I can watch what I say. Now I can check in with students. Now I can ask them, how are they doing, before I ask, why did you do that? Falsely accusing students or accusing students for doing something, or, you know, jumping to conclusions or assuming anything, you know, reflecting upon that. I mean, obviously I'm still on the journey, right? It's like, it's a moment by moment thing, you know, reflecting on your racial identity as white people. I think that's huge especially for me, because I'm in the dominant groups in America, right? I'm white. Christian male, right? So I'm in this position of just power, really, whether I like it or not. I have to use that power in a way that dismantles white supremacy. And so, and I can start that in a classroom, right? I can do that by listening more, by not trying to always feel like I have the control, right? Or trying to talk over students or talk over people. It's so easy for me to be apathetic, because if I don't do anything, then the status quo is going to benefit me no matter what, right? And so if I don't do anything, that upholds the status quo, and things are going to be fine for Blake. But thinking back, it's like, you know, you're given all this, and you know, use this like hot topic term, which is white privilege, which is completely real and something that I've learned through educating myself and learning and reflecting, is that like, I've been given this a lot of privilege, right? And what am I using my voice for? What am I using my time, my talents for? You know, am I sitting back and I'm just letting things happen? Or am I speaking up when I see injustice, or speaking up when I see things that I don't think are right? Because the fact of the matter is, like, I'm already have this platform, you know, I'm this white person in America, white male in America, and I don't want to, and I love to see representation, right? I love to see people, you know, being represented in government, being represented at, you know, in their schools. You know, students, they need to see that. They need to see those role models. They need to see those people that look like them and say, hey, like, I can be that person because that person can do it, right? And for me, it's like, you know, I never had that problem. Like, I never had to like, oh, I wish I could see someone white or Christian or male or whatever in this position of power, because like, that's kind of been the norm, right? And so it's my, you know, it's got to be part of my life's work to change that narrative, to change that part of it, where like, how can I uplift other people to use me as a platform, or use me as a step stool to get to that level? And that's one of the good things about teachers. You can inspire them to do those things.
No, I think those are all really good points. And something that really stuck out to me is you have done a lot of work on educating yourself and really just filling yourself with knowledge, but you're applying it in your space and as an educator. I feel like that becomes a challenge for people. How does what I'm doing in my career and my like space, how does this kind of fit in with this race equity work? And you talk about, you know, even specific things like school to prison pipeline and all the stuff that applies directly to working in a school. But how did you take that knowledge from just like book knowledge to actually applying it to like what you're specifically doing as an educator?
I think I'm still doing it. Like, I think I'm still learning ways to apply it. I think I'm still figuring out. Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, because I can say go to the trainings, right? Learn book knowledge, and a lot of times it stops there, right? But to take it further, it's like it's being active in the community that you're in the space that you're in. Speak up. You know, activism isn't always protests. It isn't always, you know, standing on the front lines with signs. It's having these tough conversations with the people around you, with your coworkers, with your white spaces. It's not being afraid to talk about race as a white person, which I know a lot of people are. They're you know, it's scary talking about race. You know, before this podcast, I'm like, all right, you know, I don't want to mess up and say the wrong thing, but it's like we have to normalize talking about race, because it is a thing, and it has real impacts for a lot of people in America. And so we have to normalize that. We have to speak, you know, about it. And especially in our white spaces. And I think, you know, as a teacher, again, I just come back to like empathy. Right. And, you know, there's this quote by Dr. Brian Loritz. He's a pastor and an activist. It says proximity breeds empathy, distance breeds suspicion. And so the closer you are to people of color in your circles, the more empathy and more compassion you're going to have for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk about growing up in Hawaii, where, you know, I only knew a few black people and their struggles, and I didn't understand what they went through. I don't understand their you know, the plight of having this this history of, or just kind of like this, all these, you know, white supremacist laws and policies, and having all this kind of weight on them, and just having to fight with basically one arm behind their back. Seeing that and learning about, like, wow, I have to seek diversity, Brooke. I have to go for these diverse spaces. If I'm in a space where it's mostly white people, then I need to change it up. Or if it's all white people, then I need to find a new group. You know, some people will say, oh no, that's reverse racism or whatever, but it can't be, because we as white people, we actually hold the social power, right, of being white in America, of having this, you know, this upbringing. We have already that white power. So it's like, it's one of those things where you just have to seek, you have to seek it out, and you have to do what you can to be in community. Like, I think about my church, very diverse church. You know, you'll see all kinds of people there. It's been so impactful to see that, you know, to worship alongside people of different colors. Like, I can't stress that enough. So
to your point, I mean, we live in one of the most diverse cities in the US. So when we're talking about proximity and cultivating like a diverse community, we're in one of the easiest spaces, right, to like do that. And so that was convicting for me to think, like, I'm living in one of the most diverse cities in the US, yet like most of my friends are white. And so why does my immediate community look very different of what the entire community of Houston looks like? And it shouldn't be that way.
100% agree. Houston, I love Houston because of that, right? Because of that diversity. Look at your friends, right? Who are you doing life with? Who are you listening to? What kind of like media are you putting in front of you? What books are you reading? What podcasts are you listening to? What social media accounts are you following? Because all that feeds into your brain, and you're socializing yourself within that. Mm-hmm. And if it's just from one side, if, you know, politically, if it's just all from the right, all from the left, or if it's all from, you know, all white people or all black people, whatever, it's like you really have to listen. You really have to. And we as white people, the responsibility is on us. You got to have those friends that challenge you, push you to like, are you like, what have you been educating yourself upon? You know, have that couple people, that group, because it's easy. Like I said, it's easy to get apathetic. You know, it's like, oh, there's this like term that, you know, Ibram Kendi uses in how to be an anti-racist. That's like, drop the allies, and we got to be co-conspirators or something like that. Right. Mm-hmm. We have to like be in the fight with them, not just like on the sidelines, kind of like cheering on and reposting, but it's like, what are we sacrificing, or what's the cost to us as white people, right?
Like you said earlier, you've done a lot of education, and I personally have seen you kind of go on this journey. What difference have you seen as you're going through this journey, but what difference have you seen with you know, within your classroom, with being able to, you mentioned earlier, like having empathy and the importance of that. How has this impacted your life and the people that you interact with?
It's so hard to compare differences because of the whole situation of the pandemic and how we're like online learning and in-person learning. The whole game has been changed. Just from that perspective alone, without all like the racial education I've been doing, we're also in a pandemic. We're also trying to just be here and present. So that on top of like with the racial education, what I've been reading and all that stuff, I think the change is more empathy. And I think my student relationships obviously are a lot better now. Well, back then I was also a new teacher as well. So I'm still learning like different techniques of how to, you know, manage a classroom. You know, I love what I do. I want to continue teaching and I want to continue to get better and just improve. But it's one of those things where it's like, you know, you just want to arrive at that position. You want to be like, okay, finally I made it. Like things are so much better now. But it's like also at the same time, it's a journey. It's hard to look back even just a couple of years and say, I made it, or like my, you know, everything's running so smooth in my class now. I don't have any racial problems, or like I don't have any racist thoughts or any racial like implicit bias that I'm going through. Like it's a constant. You got to check yourself if you want to be truly like anti-racist. It's one of those things where it's such a journey, and it's hard, and it's supposed to be hard. And if it's easy, then you're not doing it right. I think reflection is huge. You know, how is it today? What was that conversation with that student? What questions are you asking them to check in with them?
Why do you feel like this is an important conversation for educators in America and for teachers who maybe don't know where to start? What would you say and what would you recommend?
Yeah, so this is important because we as white people talk for, you know, it's, we have to talk to ourselves in the collective a lot of times, right? Like we're so used to this individuality or individualism, like, oh, I'm different from all the other white people. It's like, no, we are all, you know, we're white people. And it's our responsibility to educate ourselves, because really like black and brown bodies are at stake, whether you want to accept it or not. Like that's the reality of it. And with someone's life, with a group of people's life at stake, it's all the more important and urgent that we educate, that we educate other people, that we speak up when we see injustice. And it starts with the classroom. Like, what are you teaching? Are you teaching racist narratives? Are you really going to dig down into the ugly part of America and teach real history stories that I didn't even learn? I'm learning a lot of stories, even in Houston too. But the Camp Logan mutiny, I just researched that recently, and that was happened just at Memorial Park back in the 1920s. And I had to educate myself on that. So like, this is my back door. But going from that, like, it's not good just to know that. You have to take that and apply it and grow. And so for beginning teachers, or for beginning, you know, people in my field who are white, who want to do better, it's number one, read, educate yourself. Number two, get in those diverse spaces. Don't be afraid to talk about race with your white friends. In fact, you know, insist upon it, get uncomfortable. Like I said earlier, Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, is a good place to start. I read What Does It Mean to Be White by Robin DiAngelo, and I learned a lot about my racial identity, seeing myself through a racial lens through that book. So I recommend that one. Yeah, get uncomfortable for sure. Normalize talking about race.
Yeah, I think that's huge. And the more uncomfortable conversations you have, the more it will normalize.
You already know that I'm planning to move back to Maui. And I think one of the big things is whenever you move out of a different space, it's like, okay, I'm moving into a different place with different people, obviously going back home to be with family, but I want to keep this momentum going of like, I'm still going to fight for that. And I think when you think about Hawaii, I mean, I grew up in this racialized space already. There is some racial tension in Hawaii sometimes between white people and Native Hawaiians, and it's a skin color thing too, because it's race, right? It's learning more about that and getting educated on. I think one of the things I learned is that we carry, as white people, we carry our racial histories with us. So when you go to Hawaii and you feel like you're being treated badly by the local people there, it's like, dang, like why you got to be so mean to me? But also at the same time, it's like there's this passed down hurt, right, from generation to generation since the Hawaiian monarchy was overthrown by a white person, by white people, right? And it's just like, you can't just like immediately, okay, no more, like carrying that with you. And I'm still learning about how that intersects with like going through you know, returning as a white teacher there, or hopefully returning as a white teacher there, and like having to navigate these, also these really racial issues that sometimes get swept under the rug because Hawaii is a small place. People don't talk about it too much. Right. But like, how can I use my whiteness or whatever to inspire, uplift other people and not myself. Right.
Yeah. I think it's neat that you've already started thinking about and looking into how like race uniquely impacts the space that you're going to be entering into. Even going back to like the exploration that you've done with Houston, every space has that unique history. And so I think that's neat that you've already started to explore that and look into it and prepare yourself.
Yeah, trying to, for sure. I'm super pumped to be back home. I love Maui. I love Lahaina. I love my hometown for sure.
We're losing a good one. Yeah.
I'm gonna miss you too, Brooke. I'm gonna miss you too, Brooke. I know. Shout out to Jeff. I feel like I gotta make a Jeff shout out every time since the first one.
There you go. Shout out to Jeff. He listens to my podcast on 2x speed, so it'll sound something like Jeff. Like Blake, thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks for sharing your experience and in your space, and I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's been a great, great discussion. Yeah, excited.
Truly, what an important conversation with a call to action that cannot be ignored. Whether you're an educator or not, the message is something we must all take to heart in order to create a more equitable community around us that starts by seeking to understand the experiences of others around us, especially those who don't look like us. This episode is releasing exactly 1 year after the murder of George Floyd. 1 year ago, I began taking a harder look at what it means to be white in America and the extent to which my experiences differ from experiences of Black and Brown people residing around me, and ultimately what it truly means to build a community that is equitable for everyone. With humility, I realize that I'm late to this conversation, but I'm determined to make it a part of my mission to pursue justice and equity and to not be quick to forget the importance of this work or deem it complete by my own standards. I want to recognize the hard road that lies ahead to make this world just and equitable for everyone that resides in it. And guys, this is an all skate. You know, the term at roller rinks that calls everyone to the rink to skate. Basically, I'm saying there is no one exempt from doing this work. All right, guys, thanks for listening to the show today. I hope it leaves you feeling challenged and encouraged to cultivate community in your own space. And know that I'm cheering you on in that. The podcast has a new episode every other Wednesday. Follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so that you don't miss the next show on Wednesday, June 9th, with head roaster of Clio Roasting, Vivian Nguyen. Other than that, guys, I hope you have a great rest of your week, and I'll see you back here on June 9th. Later.